chaos, human rights abuses, and violence. There's no single cause, no single enemy, and no single solution. And when it comes to dealing with counterterrorism within each country and managing the refugee crisis, NATO doesn't serve as the first responder. National governments and the European Union are far more in the lead. But when it comes to addressing the root causes of the instability in our southern neighborhood, as we say at NATO, NATO has a significant role in support of the wider international community. For more than a decade, of course, NATO's mission in Afghanistan, which the United States was the main part, was to ensure that that country never again became a safe haven for international terrorism. But the job is not finished there, and we pledge to remain in Afghanistan and to support their security forces for the long term. It's no longer a combat mission for the United States or NATO, but we're still actively engaged with our militaries in trying to train, advise, and assist the Afghan security forces. Ultimately, in the next year or two, that will transition to a civilian-led mission, but we pledge to stick with Afghanistan to help them further develop the capacity to defend themselves and prevent terrorism from regaining control in that part of the world. Now, with respect to ISIL, or the Islamic State, every NATO ally is serving as part of the U.S.-led coalition aimed at destroying ISIL. The operation itself is not a NATO-led operation, but one key reason why the many nations coalition, including partners such as some of the Arab countries, Australia, Sweden, Finland. One reason they're all able to work together so effectively is the many years that they've spent serving side by side in difficult NATO-led operations, whether it's in the former Yugoslavia in the 90s, or in Afghanistan. More directly, NATO is supporting the international community in other ways. Just in the last 2 months, we've deployed some of our naval ships to the Aegean Sea between Greece and Turkey to assist in managing the refugee crisis. And this is a mission that may continue for some time. But I think the most important contribution that we're making that I will highlight is similar to what we're now doing in Afghanistan. We call defense capacity building for many of the neighboring countries along the Mediterranean and throughout the Middle East and North Africa. The aim is to help build the capacity of local forces and of local institutions so that they're better able to counter terrorism and prevent destabilization on their own. So we're training Iraqi officers, just actually starting yesterday. A group of Iraqi officers arrived in a training facility in Jordan where NATO and Jordanian trainers are helping to improve their ability to fight terrorism, to counter provide explosive devices and the like. We're also working to build the capacity of Jordan itself, which is very much on the front lines of all the troubles bordering on Iraq and Syria. We're working with Tunisia. We're helping to train their intelligence forces and their special forces. And we're working with countries across North Africa, including Morocco, Mauritania. And we also work with some of the regional organizations in that part of the world, including the African Union, the Arab League, and the Gulf Cooperation Council. And we coordinate closely with the European Union, which also does capacity building in that part of the world. But I would say that what we're doing is still rather modest in its scale, and I think NATO could be doing a lot more. We're going to have a real strategic impact on the stability of our neighborhood. We should be devoting more resources as an alliance than we do now. And we're having a big summit meeting this summer in Warsaw, and I hope that a higher degree of ambition for defense capacity building will be among the items that our leaders decide in favor of that summit meeting. Now, dealing with the terrorist threat would be enough to keep us quite busy in Brussels all by itself. But of course, we also face separate and equally formidable challenge to the whole international rules-based order to our east. That's, of course, a challenge from a Russia that has become newly aggressive, revisionist in its view of European security, and attempting to reclaim past glories by trying to expand its sphere of influence and, to a sense, dictate terms with neighbors rather than respecting their sovereignty. Now, I should mention that after the Cold War, in the early and mid-90s, we did everything that we could do to reach out to Russia. And I was very proud to be a big part of this in one of my first assignments working at NATO as the U.S. deputy ambassador, and then later in the late 90s as ambassador. NATO, in effect, reinvented itself after the end of the Cold War. Instead of being aimed at keeping the Russians and the East Europeans out, our objective became to build a Europe whole, free, and at peace through various initiatives aimed at integrating European security. NATO offered, as a first step, partnerships under the rubric of the Partnership for Peace, which helped countries reform not only their militaries but their societies, and to create the institutions that ultimately enabled both of them to actually become members. In the late 90s and the first part of the century. We also, of course, Russia was invited to become the partner of the East. And we also, outside of NATO, brought on the G8, World Trade Organization. And in the late 90s, as NATO enlarged began, we offered Russia a special relationship with NATO. Under the NATO-Russia Founding Act. And we developed a lot of very valuable and mutually beneficial cooperation with Russia over the years. We even had Russian troops serving side by side with NATO troops in bringing peace to Bosnia and Herzegovina and later Kosovo. But sadly, the situation today is quite different. 2 years ago, Russia invaded and illegally annexed Crimea. Region of Ukraine, becoming the first European state to take a part of another's territory by force since World War II. Of course, Russia has been holding disputed territory in Moldova and Georgia now for some time as well. In the last few years, Russia has massively increased its defense spending and modernized its armed forces. It holds huge snap exercises without any advance notification, including one that it used as a cover for the actual seizure of Crimea. It's using nuclear rhetoric to intimidate its neighbors, even non-NATO neighbors like Sweden. And it challenges NATO allies directly, flying its aircraft in or close to our airspace without turning on the transponders, creating a huge risk of accidents. Military or civilian aircraft. And then last year we had the new development of Russia entering the war in Syria, ostensibly to fight terrorism, but in practical terms it was clear that they were there to support the regime of President Assad. And it's been conducting military operations very close to NATO airspace, which has had a direct impact on Turkey. So the military balance in the Eastern Mediterranean is very much changing as a result of the Russian buildup in the region. So, the response to this newly aggressive Russian behavior is partly NATO's responsibility, but it's also a wider response of the international community. The main response to the aggression against Ukraine, of course, has been economic sanctions, travel bans on Russian officials responsible for the aggression and occupation of Ukrainian territory, and Russian exclusion from the G8, and a freeze on practical cooperation between NATO and Russia. direct response, of course, is to go back to basics. We're implementing the largest increase in our collective defense since the Cold War, based on major decisions that we took at our summit in Wales, in the UK, 2 years ago. Basically, because of the aggressive behavior of the Russians and the slaves, and the potential that they could apply this against our own member states, we had to increase the readiness of our forces, the ability to deploy more rapidly. We've developed what's called the Spearhead Force, which is able to bring a whole brigade forward this warning of potential aggression in a matter of days. We've had to expand our command structure to the territory of our new member states in the east. And we're conducting a continuing pattern of rotational military exercises, both to reassure our own members, but to show the Russians they shouldn't even think about threatening the alliance. The U.S. has played a major part in all of this with a program called the European Reassurance Initiative. And Secretary of Defense Ash Carter just recently announced quadrupling of this program for the next 2 years, which will mean more U.S. forces rotating in Europe, more joint training with our allies, pre-positioning of equipment so that we're able to respond more quickly. In short, we're developing 21st century approach to deterrence in view of the increased threat that we see in the East. So in addition to dealing with terrorism, the summit that we're planning for in Warsaw will be very much about taking important decisions on a robust deterrence posture, including potentially increasing our permanent presence. Now let me stress that in doing all this, our aims are strictly defensive. The scale of the measures that I just described are relatively modest. They're enough to deter, but they're certainly not aimed at posing any threat of aggression against Russia. And indeed, we're keeping open our channels to dialogue. We continue to hope that Russia will come back into compliance with international law, respect the sovereignty of its neighbors, and create conditions for rebuilding a partnership with Russia, which is still our long-term goal. But I fear that it'll be a bit, we'll have to wait a little bit before we can see a significant change in Russian behavior. Unfortunately, President Putin now is basing a lot of his power on promoting a very aggressive nationalism, using a very aggressive use of Russian state TV and other media to shape public opinion. And I think President Putin, if anything, needs to preserve an enemy image of the United States and NATO in order to maintain his grip on power at home. So early changes in Russian behavior are not likely, but we have to remain firm, stick to our principles, and not compromise on the notion that Russia's neighbors deserve to have their sovereignty and their borders respected, and their decisions on whether to join the European Union or seek NATO membership to be their decisions and not subject to any detail by Russia. But having a strong defense and a strong deterrent, of course, history has shown, gives us a more solid basis on which to engage in dialogue with Russia and ultimately to influence its behavior over the long term. So we will continue to engage. We may have a meeting of our NATO-Russia Council in the coming weeks, but this is not meant to signify any return to business as usual. I think we have to gird ourselves for a period of long-term strategic competition with Russia. So that's kind of an overview of the main issues we're working on in NATO, but there's many other dimensions which I'm happy to address during Q&A. But I just stress again that to deal with the threats that we're dealing with today, it takes teamwork, and when it comes to international teamwork, NATO is the most successful team in history. As I said, it's an alliance of 28 open democracies with shared values and shared interests. think despite some of the things you hear in the political debates, we've seen that just as America stood by the Europeans during the Cold War, so the Europeans and also Canadians, who shouldn't be forgotten, have stood with the United States in recent years, including after 9/11. Our allies have served alongside American forces. Yes, indeed, the Baltic states in particular are the most exposed, the most vulnerable. And when we started the enlargement of NATO in the 90s, it seemed inconceivable that we would have to worry about Russian aggression again, but sadly, we're back in that situation. But we don't intend to go back literally to the model that was used along the inner German border in the Cold War. First of all, we don't have hundreds of thousands of troops at our disposal, the U.S. or Europe. Plus, we have many different potential fronts to defend. So the basic paradigm is still going to be largely based on the ability to rapidly reinforce, bring deployable forces in rapidly enough to counter any aggression. But clearly, reinforcement alone is not enough. So what we're actually debating right now in the run-up to the summit in Warsaw is how much additional forward presence do we need so that even before those reinforcements were on the ground, we could effectively, at least impose some serious costs on invading Russian forces or the little green men who might infiltrate without insignias and try to destabilize the situation using so-called hybrid warfare model rather than direct aggression. So we're debating what's how much is enough, but I think the debate is pointing towards at least one fully mechanized combat battalion in each country, these forces should be multinational. The most effective deterrent would be a combination of well-equipped home defense forces, which in the case of the Baltic states would be relatively strong. Some U.S. forces and some European forces. And I think there's emerging agreement that this is the right way to go, and we'll finalize the decisions on this in the coming months. The battalion doesn't sound like a huge amount of capabilities, but that would be the kind of the spearhead that would buy you time for the so-called spearhead force, the very high readiness task force, flowing other high readiness forces that nations have at 2 or 3 days of work. So that you would have a credible capability to deter or defend balancing forward presence and reinforcement capability. Europeans, I think, will play a big part in this. The decisions we took 2 years ago have been largely implemented by the European forces. This very high readiness joint task force based on a lead nation rotating each year. We've got the UK, France, Germany, Italy, Spain, Poland, and Turkey each taking turns being in the lead for this force. And then they also have high responsibilities in receiving it in subsequent years. You've got a lot of other allies contributing smaller units, niche capabilities, enabling capabilities. So it's been a pretty good show on the part of Europe, and I think it gets alive the notion that these are just a bunch of preloaders. Yes, we wish they were spending more on defense in some cases. Germany in particular is very, very low when it comes to the percentage of GDP. UK and France are at 2%, Poland's at about 2%. The trends are slowly turning in the right direction. But when it comes to actual commitments, these new initiatives to defend our eastern flank or to support overseas missions in Afghanistan and elsewhere, the Europeans have been there. So that's, I think, the most I can say right now. These are just the decisions in progress, but I think there's some good decisions.
Thank you. Anybody else?
You like Matt? You had mentioned earlier the issue of breakaway states in places like Moldova, Georgia, and Ukraine. I know that at least some of those countries have been attempting to cooperate with NATO, but the breakaway states have been somewhat of an impediment because accepting them into an alliance would imply war with Russia, something like that. What level of cooperation is possible with a country that has a non-NATO member occupying part of its territory?
It is a complicating factor. In the case of Georgia and Moldova, of course, the roots of these problems go back to the breakup of the Soviet Union in 1991. And in the years immediately afterward, there were separatist movements, internal conflicts, many civil wars that led to the breakaway in Moldova of the years. Then the Russians went further by stimulating an armed insurgency in parts of Eastern Ukraine. This doesn't make it difficult to cooperate, but we are extending extensive security assistance and cooperation for all three countries. That's both on a bilateral level. The U.S. has a very large defense assistance program for all three countries. And NATO has, in the case of Georgia, we have a liaison office, defense advisor. Training and evaluation center for the armed forces. We're doing what we can to help the Georgians build up their own self-defense capabilities and their ability to contribute to the NATO mission. Probably a little known fact that Georgia actually is the second biggest troop contributor in Afghanistan after the United States. We surpassed all 27 NATO allies. So these countries have a right to seek closer relations with NATO, and in the case of Georgia, of course, they are a declared candidate for membership. Ukraine was at one point seeking membership and might want to get back on that track again in the future. It's obviously difficult to defend a country that has Russian troops on its territory, so it's going to take time. But I think it's a matter of principle that we have to stand up for the country's freedom to choose, while at the same time trying to build a better relationship with Russia that ends these frozen conflicts, gets foreign forces off sovereign territory and partner states, and creates the conditions in which membership becomes feasible. Maybe sometimes even the leadership in Moscow are doing this today. But we have to do what we can short of that to help them develop their own capabilities and Moldova, we have a defense capacity building program. It's in a very early stage. That country is in a basket case right now. Had a big political government crisis in the last few months. Ukraine is going through internal political problems right now. They've been struggling for the last 4 weeks or so. Government debt, they break down consensus to support the current government. So ultimately, these countries have to help themselves, but I think they deserve strong financial support. They want to support part of the equation of doing this.
Hey, so my question has to do with Turkey. Turkey, of course, is a NATO ally under the leadership of Erdogan, has shown unsteady commitment to especially the counterterrorism measures that are part of NATO's mission. And so what has Turkey done recently to reaffirm its commitment to NATO's values of shared defense and cooperation?
Scott was not expecting these. Didn't think that question would come up. It's a very, very relevant question. I stressed that NATO is an alliance of shared values, and of course we all have some concerns about the internal trends in the recent crackdown on some of these papers. Questions about consistent application of the law in that country. At the same time, we have to recognize that Turkey faces a genuine internal terrorist threat from the Kurdish Workers' Party, AK. And of course, Turkey is in a very dangerous place on the map, since we have borders with Iraq and Syria, as well as Iran. But Turkey still contributes in a lot of different ways to our collective missions in the alliance. They have some substantial troops in Afghanistan, because they maintain large armed forces for their own self-defense. They've looked to NATO in recent months to provide reinforcements to deter any spillover territory. Several countries have beefed up air defenses, missile defenses. We have AWACS planes flying patrols over Turkey. But it's a mixed picture. Turkey, of course, is also very much the victim of the spillover of the Syrian conflict in terms of more than 2.5 million refugees. So we have to kind of continue to support our Turkish allies while being honest with them about the problems that could undermine actually is still more pluses than minuses. And strategically, we don't want to see trouble or aggression on this NATO's set up. Perhaps more in private conversations than in the official negotiations. Security summit, which is not directly about nuclear weapons. We have bilateral channels to talk about that with Russia. It's about, in particular, international cooperation to prevent terrorists from acquiring nuclear weapons. It's about promoting non-proliferation, tighter safeguards on peaceful nuclear technology, nuclear fuel. So there's a lot that nations can do without Russia's participation, but it would be better if Russia were in, because Russia historically has been a good partner in combating the proliferation of nuclear weapons and nuclear weapons technology. They've been part of many initiatives to transfer of missile material, to ensure the strong safeguards by the International Energy Agency. So there's a lot of things Russia has done in the past that we hope they'll continue to do, even though they didn't show up at this particular summit meeting. But the rest of the international community, I think, has a very big agenda coming out of this meeting. Hopefully maybe Russia can be brought in after the fact on some of the initiatives launched at the security summit. On the more direct question of the nuclear arms control process, unfortunately, Russia has rejected proposals from President Obama to further reduce strategic nuclear weapons beyond the levels of the new START agreement that came into effect in 2010. President Obama offered a one-third cut in the levels, and Russia said no. They think they want to build up rather than reduce nuclear weapons. Of course, there's strong concerns all across the world and across NATO about evidence the Russians have violated one of the landmark treaties of the 1980s, the intermediate range nuclear forces treaty, by developing and testing a ground launched cruise missile that has a range that violates the treaty. And NATO has tried to engage the Russians in the last couple years on reducing tactical nuclear weapons, short-range systems that are still deployed in, both in NATO in very small numbers and in Russia in very large numbers. But the Russians have declined to engage in that negotiation either. They've even refused in an initial step to be more transparent, to exchange information for available. So right now the Russians are more interested in raising tensions than reducing tension. But it's one of those areas where we have to be patient. Try to remind the Russians that it's in their own interest to reduce the risks of nuclear conflict. So, disappointing, not the end of the world, but we can still cooperate among the rest of the world. That's a deal breaker, but it's
that you've had as interviewers with the meetings, some countries bought in, for some initiatives in North Africa and the Middle East. Have you experienced this same kind of difficulty now with the buildup of
for the initiatives at the front door.
I'm not sure I heard the question fully clearly. There's microphone capacity. But the microphone build up in the Middle East?
No, so I'm sorry. You seem to mention that you've had difficulty getting NATO members bought into NATO initiatives, perhaps financially, in the Middle East and in North Africa. And in your experience, have you experienced similar difficulties for initiatives in sort of the deterrence and containment of Russia? Or have you seen the new commitment by the United States at like this week's announcement as indication of it?
That brings up an interesting dimension to NATO. Clearly, 28 countries and different geographical parts of the alliance, they'll have different priorities. But what I think has been encouraging about the last couple of years as we've confronted challenges in the East and the South, there's sort of a sense that we're all in this together. We have to be doing things that address everybody's concerns. So the mantra these days is you need a 360-degree neighborhood strategy. So we're active on all fronts. Now, that doesn't always translate into perfection when it comes to decisions. But I think this goes beyond political correctness. I think just nations generally understand that if NATO is going to be effective and politically united for the long haul, we do have to scratch each other's backs. So we are seeing, I think, pretty good performance, as I was saying, in the first place. When it comes to Europeans committing troops and resources to reinforce our eastern flank, protect the most exposed countries, the Baltics, Poland, etc., committing more ships to our naval fleet, so that we have more assets if we went to the Black Sea or to other challenging areas. I expressed this frustration a little more difficult when it comes to the southern neighborhood, because even the southern allies aren't sure what they want to do. These defense capacity building programs that I mentioned are not hugely expensive, but they cost money. You have to assign more personnel to go implement them. Or if you do it through the military, of course you have to divert military trainers to go to Tunisia or Jordan rather than sending them somewhere else. So the southern allies are debating how much more they want NATO to do as opposed to the European Union, or how much they want to do international level. There's a little bit of turf competition. Some of the members of NATO who are also in the EU want to say, let's give the EU first priority, the option of first resort. And only use NATO for whatever crumbs are left over. And that's, I think, short-sighted, because if you look at the world as it is, there's more than enough work to go around. And we should be using every tool that we can think of to address these problems. Certainly preventing conflict by assisting these countries now is better than having to go in with thousands of troops to put out the fire later. So, but it's more a question of nations kind of not making up their mind on what they really want to do than any regional competition or the lack of solidarity.
I'd like to go back to Turkey for a second. You mentioned PKK being considered a terrorist group. A couple weeks ago, we had the former U.S. ambassador to Syria here talking, and he had a picture up on the screen of the YPG officer knocked out with the YPG behind the Russian flag, and a picture of the head of the PKK behind the president of Turkey. So how do we reconcile our support for the YPG in Syria when we're trying to put pressure on Turkey?
Ford, you had here?
Yeah.
Okay. Interested to see how he answered that question. It's one of the hardest questions. let me say, I don't speak for the U.S. government. I'm only speaking for NATO, and unfortunately, we don't have to solve this conundrum, but it is a real conundrum, because on the one hand, the YPG is one of the more effective fighters against ISIL in northern northeast Syria. And that's the priority for the U.S. But it's also true that they are an extension of the PKK. And they have a national agenda to set up autonomous province. And they declare independence. I'm curious. They're not directly involved in the fighting of the Turkish government, but they are part of the broader organization that creates a real dilemma. And it's created real strains in the U.S. bilateral relationship with Turkey. Because there's no obvious alternative to supporting the YPG to achieve the goals we're trying to achieve inside Syria. And then the Russians cozying up to the YPG just makes it even more complicated. Three-dimensional chess designed by the American Commission. I don't know what the right answer is. I think at the end of the day, I would say we have to put the ultimate security of Turkey first. They're our ally. In some ways, they're kind of the linchpin country in the region. And if we undermine our ability to help them fight their terrorists in a legitimate way, but also use our leverage to steer them back on the democratic path, we suffer much more in the long term. So we have to find some way to find alternatives or additional means to reduce our dependence on the YPG if we can, for the sake of the broader position. I do think, as I said before, that a lot of this is driven by domestic politics and the need to hold on to power, using nationalism and the establishment of Russian greatness as part of that effort. But I think they're genuinely convinced that they are somehow entitled to the sphere of influence, the sphere of dominance over the former Soviet Republic. Ironic. The Russians have used the slogan for their kind of democracy, called sovereign democracy. So nothing is more important than sovereignty. The Westerners are trying to take our sovereignty away. If you ask them about the sovereignty of Ukraine, they say they don't get sovereign. They don't say it that way, but that's effectively their view. These historically belong to Russia. There isn't a sense of question. I mean, there's a lot of opportunism, impulsiveness. But of course, what they did in Crimea wasn't something that they just kind of made up on the spot. They had plans. Clearly, they had a well-developed plan for this operation. Very good plan. They used a little bit of the forces that they had under a treaty with Ukraine, the naval base, using them illegally but effectively outside of those bases. Basically garrison the whole place until the Ukrainians had a chance. So they may have similar plans to peace with Kazakhstan, or to go further than they are now in Georgia, or to start something else in Moldova, but that's harder now that they can't really afford to change the process. I think there's a distinction between this former Soviet space where they do feel entitled to be dominated, where they do seem to feel more comfortable when these countries are unstable and weak than our country would be. We like them strong. Europeans, they don't feel strong. Feel more secure if they're strong, prosperous, stable. The rest of Soviet space and NATO. Even with our limited forces right now that we're still working to ramp up, so we have more deterrence. I think Russia just deterred today. They made it harass and create intimidating effects through their exercises. Policy keeping your neighbors unstable under your domination is inherently unsustainable. Because the local people have a vote. And they're not going to put up with being colonized by Russia in the 21st century.
I'll ask a naive question. So we're living in a somewhat similar but really radically different era from the early days of NATO, right? I mean, this is the era of Stuxnet, the era of the OPM hack. So are these structures... What's that?
A little louder, please.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. See, we're living in a similar but quite a bit different era than the early days of NATO with the Stuxnet virus and the OPM hack, right? I mean, these are acts of war in some ways, depending on where you are. So are the structures that we have, the relationships and structures we have that you described, are they still relevant? I mean, is that, over the next decade, is this what we should be spending our time, our blood, our treasure on?
The answer is yes and no. Mm-hmm. The world hasn't changed completely. I mean, there's still clearly roles for military forces for deterrence, but also for the soft power tools that we've developed over many decades. Mm-hmm. Things like defensive capacity building, building coalitions, all these things are very relevant. At the same time, we have to adapt to the new technological challenges. Mm-hmm. Cyber defense is an area where NATO has been devoting a lot of energy, starting first with the minimum requirement, which is to ensure that our own networks are better. Even if we're not as able as we would like to be to get those reinforcements in or have enough forward presence, we could respond easily. Or with another top of the word, horizontally, necessarily on a different front. With military force, we could respond asymmetrically with cyber or some other technology. So that all that adds up to 21st century. I would highly recommend obligation.